Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours. In store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. 51551 is our text number, as usual. Sharon Best has contacted us. Sharon, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
And you've contacted us, unfortunately, about the untimely passing of your dear father, Martin Best. Can you tell us what happened, Sharon?
On the 12th of January 2019, yeah. My dad died. And it all kind of started off with him being admitted to hospital in December 2018. He spent a while in hospital because it was like a respiratory infection first to begin with, and he was kind of wheezy. So when he went in, we thought like it was just kind of a flu cold or a chest infection. Going forward, he ended up with pneumonia. He ended up in ICU. And by the 4th of January, his condition like had improved to the extent that he was being considered, you know, for to be discharged from ICU.
Yeah.
And he was going to be transferred to a ward. And after that, when he arrived on the ward, he had many visits from family members and was, you know, in really great form and really looking forward to coming home. And then on the Tuesday morning, the 8th of January, I had a couple of calls with Dad. Myself and my daughter were here in the house, and we rang him that morning because we were all excited that he was coming home. And being the dad that he was, he rang, first of all, asking me, had I had my bins put out, you know, were the dogs okay, you know, things like that. And then he asked, how are my girlies, which he used to refer to my two daughters. And then my daughter spoke to him, and she apologised, you know, for the fact that she couldn't attend hospital while he was in it, because we always protected him if we had a flu because of his COPD. That we didn't ensure that, you know, that we wouldn't be around him, so that we wouldn't, you know, give him a chest infection or anything that to worsen his illness. But he was always so careful with his, you know, colds and flus, and visited doctors and everything, like, you know, to make sure, you know, he was in good health. He really took his health serious. So at the end of, we had the first call, and then he called me back on the second call. And while we were speaking, he told me, he said, oh, sorry, I have to go. He said, the doctor is here and he's come to take this thing out of my neck. But he said, I'll call you back afterwards. And that was around 10:45 or so in the morning. So a short time later, my phone rang. So I thought it was him ringing me back. And it was my mother. And she called me explaining that the hospital had contacted her and that Dad had taken a turn and we needed to go up immediately. So obviously, I was in shock. And I told her, I had been speaking to him a few minutes ago. And I said he was fine and he was coming home. So when we arrived at the hospital, we were presented with a totally different person. Dad appeared to be paralysed on his left side. He was having what seemed like, you know, spasms in his body. His eyes were wide, you know, wide open, but he looked fearful and they were glassy, kind of with tears. He just looked terrified. He couldn't, you know, communicate to us. So we spoke to doctors and they said it's a suspected stroke. And we didn't kind of think about the line removal, and they played down the relevance of the line removal, even though we questioned it and had concerns about it.
Because that's the only procedure the family were aware of that was happening that morning. When when your dad said to you, Martin said to you, they're taking out...
I'll bring you back, they're taking this thing out. And you see, the way I felt about this thing is, you know, when you get an IV, when you go into a hospital, you know, in your arm, or you get it in your hand. we never knew, you know, about protocols or, you know, we thought it was like the same as them, take it out of your hand, put a plaster on, you'd be fine, because we were not aware of what it was, really. If we had known, we would have been there with them, you know what I mean, if we'd known the relevance of it and how important it was. So, Dad was sent for MRIs and stuff like that, you know, and they went to check if he had a stroke, and then they told us that he hadn't had a stroke. So he was moved to another ward, and we never, you know, throughout the 4 days of him dying, we never, you know, it was never discussed of really, you know, even though we questioned what was wrong with him, what had happened to him. And, you know, we'd stay there at night. You could tell, you know, we took turns, me and my siblings took turns in staying the nights with him. And his voice, his speech was slurred, like someone that had, you know, a stroke. So he couldn't really communicate properly, but he was so thirsty. And, like, I inquired with the staff, like, you know, can you check his swallow, you know, like they do after stroke patients, to see that they can feed again, or, you know, give them fluids, because all he could take was water from a sponge that we'd administer to him, you know, on the sponge to give him. And the only thing, like, in his speech, you know, it's hard to understand, is, like, I'm thirsty. And when you'd be putting the sponge in his mouth, he'd keep going, I'm thirsty. And we were told only to give him so much, you know, you couldn't give him too much fluids. You know, we were, like, completely, you know, in shock and didn't know what was wrong with him. You know, we were asking, but we weren't told, so we didn't know. Like, there was no, we were told there's no stroke, so we didn't know what was wrong. And he was suffering, like, from the Tuesday night on the ward when we were with him, and, you know, he started coughing up like brownie phlegm. They went, oh, that's only natural, you know, things like that. And on the Thursday morning, before the day before he died, I had done the night. And that morning, you know, I was getting really worried. And he was kind of gargling that night and everything. And when I was giving him fluids, they gave me a gel for his gums, you know, to kind of hydrate him. I said to her, you know, can I please speak to a doctor? And a doctor turned up, and he wasn't Dad's doctor or on Dad's team, but he just said to me, the writing's on the wall. He said, he can hear you. You know, he pulled me away from the bed and he rubbed me on the arm, and he said, he can hear you and everything. But, like, you know, he basically told me he's going to die, which we hadn't. We were living in hope and didn't know, because we had no answers. So I contacted my mum, and then we discussed palliative care, because he had explained to, I think it was my mum and my brother, that they asked him on the Thursday, are you in pain? And he went, no, I'm suffering. And so we decided, like, you know, then that we were going to think about palliative care, you know, with the fact that he was suffering. And aware, and the sad fact of it is, taking our pain away, it was worse looking at his pain. And you could tell in him, he knew he was dying. You know, for those 4 days, he knew he was dying, but he couldn't communicate it to us. Like,
and Sharon, was in those 4 days, was there any mention of the fact that the CVC catheter, the central venous catheter, which is a long flex, people know it, anyone's visited, a lot of people, a long flexible tube, in a hospital where they insert it into a vein, usually in your neck, chest, arm or groin, and it leads to a particular vein, a large vein that empties into your heart. But the protocol is that that catheter, that tube has to be removed in a very particular way, a very straightforward way. The patient cannot be sitting up. The patient has to be lying down. Now, when was that mentioned? Did anyone say, even did you hear of any medic saying to another medic, by the way, someone took out the CVC, can we just check how they took it out?
No, we were never told. It was just the stroke, and he didn't have a stroke. And in relation to the line, we did inquire at the time, and they said, no, it's nothing to do with it. Like, they straight out, they said, it has nothing to do with that. And then it was, like, very hard. We didn't see doctors. Now, the nurses were amazing. But you know, they'd, you know, they'd come in and out, and they had tears in their eyes, and they said this shouldn't have happened, and you know, they were very compassionate, but we didn't see doctors really to tell us, like, they actually said it did, you know, that it has nothing to do with the line, like, and
they actually,
you know,
they were adamant about that,
yeah, that it was nothing to do with the line. They didn't know what happened to me. It was like he was a medical mystery, really.
Yeah, but anyone, which I did when I was told about your call, anyone who Googles this, how should a CVC be removed? And it's quite clear. It's the first thing that comes up on Google. The Trendelborg position, it's called.
Yeah.
CVC should only be removed when the patient is lying flat or ideally with head tilted slightly down, with breath held at the end of exhalation. Mm-hmm. It says when patient is should only be removed when the patient is lying flat. That's, you don't need 7 years in the Royal College of Surgeons to read that.
No, even afterwards, because I didn't know a lot about it, I researched it, and it was like, you have to be lying supine, as you said. And it did shock me. The questions all came, you know, with the shock after his death of, oh my God, you know, reading this and understanding, like you said there, like, but we didn't realise at the time, like, there was no protocol there in the hospital, and I don't know, there's not a lot of hospitals in Ireland that have protocols for
which is,
it.
Which,
like,
is one of the reasons why you've called us, to call on hospitals to get that protocol installed and into everyone's head. That a CVC should only be removed when the patient is lying flat, or ideally with head tilted slightly forward, obviously lying flat, with breath held at the end of exhalation.
Yeah.
Once the CVC has been removed, gentle pressure to occlude the exit side should be applied for a minimum of 5 minutes. So it's very, it's a procedure, but it's not, it's a procedure that can be done by one person. You don't need seven different medics. It's a straightforward procedure. And that wasn't adhered to. And you were wondering, are other hospitals around the country aware of this, the importance of this basic protocol?
Yeah.
The life and death importance in your father's case.
Yeah, that's a massive worry to me, you know, like, you know, the protocol, like, nationwide, because it's hard enough to lose someone, never mind, you know, like, going through 5 years to question how you lost that person, you know, and why, you know, it's, and it was through our lack of awareness and not been told, not been informed, and it's like, really, we should have been informed, you know, of it could have been a possibility.
Take us back, Sharon, because I jumped ahead
there. Yeah, no, you're fine.
The medic says to you, you're sitting there, you're realizing your father is not improving by any stretch. But a doctor says to you, you know, there is no hope, basically.
Yeah.
And what happened thereafter? You phoned your mother, obviously in a panic.
I phoned mum and I told her what the doctor had said. And that's when we discussed palliative care, because especially when he said the word suffering, you know, to hear anyone say, you know, I'm not in pain, I'm suffering, but, like, it's cruel. So we discussed palliative care, and then on the Friday evening, Dad was moved. They moved Dad to a private ward, and Mum contacted us, and she said, you need to come up to the hospital, your dad's dying. Yeah. And I got up there with my sons. I brought my two sons up. And when I went in, Dad was awake, which just kind of clearly shows you, again, Dad was aware.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got to tell him I loved him. And he, you know, said, I love you. And then my sons got their time with him. And then I went back in and they gave him his palliative care, you know, his injection into his tummy, and he never woke again.
And when did the family become suspicious and ask the questions? Because one, you're grieving obviously horribly because of the unexpected nature of the death of a young man you thought was coming home, and a man that was obviously deeply interested and active in all your families. When did the family say, listen, we want an investigation, we want an autopsy?
That night, I think that night, we kind of became aware of it, and around nine or so, my brother, before Dad died, he went to the nurse's station and he said, after my dad passes, I want an autopsy.
Yeah.
Because we'd no answers.
Yeah, of course.
So then at 11 o'clock that night, the nurse informed us that she was finding it hard to get a reading, you know, that his BP had dropped so low. So just before 12, they said, we have to do an X-ray. Mm-hmm. And they entered Dad's room. They put us out and entered Dad's room with a portable X-ray machine. And I got angry and I said, why are you X-raying a dying man?
Yeah.
And, you know, they went in with the X-ray unit. We were thrown out. And then when they went in, they were only minutes in there and they came running back out. And at this stage, because we were put out, my mum was in the family room. And it just all became panic because they go, you have to go in. Your dad's dying. And it was like our final moments, you know, were nearly taken from us. And when we got in there, Dad was taking his last breath. And he died at 12:03. You know, I got so angry in the corridor when I seen her running down with the X-ray machine, but she didn't answer me. I said, why?
Did he ever explain why the X-ray?
Never. Never explained why they X-rayed him just before he died. I always knew if you move a body, and my daughter, even she worked in a nursing home, you know, someone's dying and you move them, you know, it makes them, you know, it really progresses, you know, the death, they die quicker. And so I feel like our final moments were taken from us there, you know, like we could have been there talking to him but we got minutes. Like it was like running down the corridor. Get your mother quick. Get in. Mm-hmm. He's dying. And we were running down the corridor to get to him and we just were lucky enough to get his final moments.
And then how soon did you realise there had been a breach of protocol? A serious breach of protocol in terms of the removal of the CVC?
We all questioned it afterwards. Obviously, we were all in a blur for the funeral. And then we contacted our solicitor, Johan Berbergen, and he took over for us, thank God. And he was absolutely amazing. And I think without him, we would never have got an inquest or, you know, got the answers, you know, to what we needed. Like, but, you know, like last week was the final hearing above in Dublin, and it was like 5 long years of pain, you know, waiting on answers and, you know, stuff like that. Like, they took such a good man, and like as I said to you earlier, to take, you know, the family itself, like taking us aside, it breaks my heart to know he knew what was going on and he couldn't communicate it to us.
The hospital accepted there was Mayo University Hospital.
Yeah.
The hospital accepted there was a deviation in protocol for the removal of the CVC lines. This is in court last Wednesday.
Yeah.
The removal of the CVC lines and allowing Mr. Best to sit up during the procedure. Yeah. It was also accepted that a coroner's post-mortem rather than a hospital post-mortem should have been arranged. The hospital manager said the issues were deeply regretted and extended apologies to the family.
Yeah.
How did you hear that?
I heard the apology in the inquest and then I heard the apology again last Wednesday. And it's so strange because when you're sitting there and you hear this apology, you just feel hurt, you know, anger and everything. Because, like, in the blink of an eye, my dad was dead and we knew he wasn't coming home.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a tough 5 years and we were all hurt and angry and still grieving.
Yeah.
And 5 years on, you know, after someone dying, you know, you should be coming through your grief. But we had never even started. And it's just sorry, what the word sorry means to them. Do you know what I mean? It's that part, just, you know, what does sorry mean after 5 years to anybody? Like, I feel that sorry means to deal with an issue, you know, immediately reveal the facts of it and then offer support.
Face up to it, face up to it.
Offer us support and then work to ensure it never happens again, like.
And you mentioned earlier, Sharon, that when you were talking to your dad, Martin, before you were going, he said, "I'm getting the CVC removed. I've got to go." And he was in full voice, and he thought he was getting out in a few days. But he asked after his girlies, and he seemed to know. Was he heavily involved in each of your lives?
Oh, he was amazing. Like, he was, Dad was all about family, all about family. Yeah. Like, because he said that evening he was going to my daughter, "I'll come over and see you this evening," because he knew she had protected him by not going up with the cold. So he said, "I'll come over to you this evening." You know, like, he felt sorry that she couldn't see him. You know, he was just such a beautiful person.
And he was an active, well, he's young, he's 67, he was an active man. He used to cut everyone's grass, which is brilliant. He used to know when to put out the wheelie bins, which is of each of his children, which is incredible knowledge in itself. So he was hands on with his family, and he obviously a worker.
He was such a hard working man. Like, he was a manager in a mill years ago, and when his boss died, he went on to another mill to manage there. Punctuality was massive with him. You always had to be on time. He was on time.
Yeah.
But his life was all about his family. Like, every achievement he was so proud of. And you know what even stings with his death is, like, you know, before you'd ever go to bed, like, he'd always say to us, "Never fall asleep on an argument," because he said life is too short and you don't want regrets. Because when Dad was in his 20s, he lost both of his parents and he had only his sister left. He lost his mother at the age of 47, you know, to cancer. And then 3 years later, his dad died at the side of the road after a massive heart attack. And he was only 59. So they were such beautiful people. And he knew, you know, anyone can go at any time. So, you know, that was a big knock to see him going so young. Because when you visit his grave now, you see like 47, 59, 67 on the graves. And you're like, that's so young. You
it's
know,
a family plot,
it's
and
so
he's saying don't fall asleep in an argument because life is short and we don't know who'll be here in the morning.
Always tell us that he never liked arguments or anything he was so proud, you know, in the family. He was proud of everyone's achievements. Even if you had a leaving cert a year to your exams, he'd say, "You can only do your best." And then once you've done it, whether you passed or failed, "I'm so proud of you, you turned up." You know, that's the kind of attitude he had about it. He loved that you'd get an education. He was proud of his grandkids. He enjoyed walking. He walked his dog for miles every day. Even his dog wasn't right after his death. His dog died there last year. You know, because he was so close. You know, he was a loving husband. He was a loving father. Yeah, he's just an amazing person.
And as you say, well, first of all, it's of no consolation in the desert of grief. It's a grain of sand, but he must be so proud of the family that pursued this and got justice in terms of, one, the acknowledgement, but two, you want to take it further. You want learning from it. You want other hospitals to be totally and completely aware of this protocol. You do not remove a CVC from a patient who is sitting up. Very simple. The patient must be lying flat.
It's. I think what I'm left with is fear. Fear is my biggest thing today. Like, because last year, my five-year-old son had to have surgery. And oh my God, when he went in there, you'd swear he was having open heart surgery, because my daughters even came up me, because now we're at this stage that we want to be there to witness what happens. And even when I had to leave him in the theatre on his own after, you know, he had his anaesthetic, it was so hard to walk away and leave him without someone been there to witness it. And I don't think that'll ever go away. And, you know, it's in my kids are even fearful, and they're adults now.
I can understand. How's your mother?
Devastated. And, you know, like, she's to learn to live her life, in that, you know, now without him. And it's like, it's shock and it's pain and grief again. Like, you know, I contacted recently, where before, like, the end of the case, and I contacted Rose Conway Walsh. And she's going to bring this forward, you know, to help Oireachtas for me, you know, and, you know, in a similar way to try, you know, the sepsis protocol, to try and get this protocol in so it can happen. It won't happen anyone else. Yeah. And maybe it'll be kind of a legacy for Dad, because he couldn't be saved, but maybe he could save someone else.
Yeah. And there's no need for massive meetings and votes and lectures and seminars and webinars in hospitals. No. It's a very straightforward protocol. A reminder, just a reminder to everybody. I know everyone is busy and everyone is up to their eyes, but reminder, very straightforward reminder that the CVC should only be removed when the patient is lying flat. Straightforward. And anyway, Sharon.
But there should be two people present as well, and there's only one. So I suppose that's to be aware. So what I want is correct techniques, appropriate precautions, stuff like that, and to make sure, that there is someone there, that there's two people there to monitor it and everything, so that no one else, and then that every unexplained death, because Dad wasn't failed once, he was failed twice, first by the removal, but secondly by not recording his death properly. And how many other unexplained deaths are out there? And that's what frightens me, for the future. That's why I'm so adamant to get this protocol nationwide.
Okay, well done, Sharon. And you're through your grief, and God rest Martin, a remarkable man, taken way too soon, unavoidably taken. Way too soon. Condolences again, Sharon, to your own generation, your mother's generation, and your children's generation who loved this man, Martin Best, so dearly. That's Sharon Best. Sharon, thanks indeed for your contact. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You too. Joe at
rte.ie. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Joe at rte.ie. John Farrelly. So many people have got this text. I presume a lot of people have fallen for it. What happened, John?
I ordered a book of poetry, Joe, online, second-hand book.
Yeah.
From an English bookshop.
Okay.
I ordered it, I think, last Wednesday, so it's going to come either today or tomorrow.
Okay.
But yesterday when I was in town, I got a little message to say that the delivery had failed.
A text message.
The delivery had failed.
Yes.
And that if I paid €3.60, they would make another attempt. Yeah. Now, I have only had one book since Christmas, and I felt, this is the one that's coming.
Okay.
I'm waiting on this. €3.60. It all seemed like what a courier firm would do.
I agreed to pay the
€3.60. There was no phone.
What was the book?
It's a book of poetry by Francis Stewart.
Okay.
Now, I had read it in the library, and it's absolutely amazing.
Okay.
And the poetry in it was released in the mid-80s, but it's 80 poems set over about 80 years.
Yeah.
Magical poetry.
And Francis Stewart was a poet and a novelist, and he was controversial in his day, wasn't he?
I know that. I'm aware he was controversial. Yeah. I picked it up by accident, Joe.
Yeah, and
I read a book of poetry in one setting, and I thought, this is the type of poems I would like to go back to. Very easy on the mind, very, very small poetry.
And remember, poetry, very, very mindful and very helpful, especially if you're stressed. But anyway, that's beside the point.
Beautiful book of poetry. Anyway,
So I
decided €3.60, I'll pay for that. I don't want the book to be sent back to England.
Okay.
I was totally unaware it could be a scam. So I filled out, I pressed a button to say I agree.
Okay.
I filled out a little invoice, and then I got another little message to say, can you confirm this payment with your bank, which I did, and which Bank of Ireland insists you do.
Okay.
And by opening that, I let them into my account, and they robbed €800 out of me.
Oh, wow. But come back to that. Now, they send you a text back, and how do they get your bank details?
They asked me, would you be prepared to pay the €3.60?
Yeah,
I pressed the button to say I would. It said, press this.
Yeah.
There was a small little sort of invoice. I filled in my name and address and my bank account number.
Ah.
Now, it still hadn't sank in.
Yeah.
I had to confirm these details. And the minute I confirmed it, they were into my bank and they got two withdrawals, one €300 and one €500.
Yeah.
Now, I went up to my bank and almost immediately afterwards, and I'm very lucky it's at the end of the lane where I live.
Okay, yeah, so sure are.
That's the reason they didn't get to remove more money, because they were doing it in small tranches.
And what you got
up...
You ran up the lane?
Yes.
Go Good man.
Now, had I not done that, probably another 300 and another 500 would have been taken out.
Oh, you bet your butt. But still, it's 800 quid gone.
Anyway, I went up to them, and I must admit, Bank of Ireland were very nice. The young fellow gave me great advice, and he put me on to the fraud section. And a woman answered it, and she was quite nice. So we filled out all the details. But as I was leaving, I said to them, you know, will I be getting my money back? And she said to me, well, I don't know about that. We'll have to decide within 10 days.
Okay.
And she said, I said, well, why is that? She said, because you let them in.
Yeah.
Now, if someone breaks into your house at night, you don't let them in. I didn't let these people in voluntarily. But what really troubled me was, how did they manage to take out money out of my account? I believe that, number one, you should either have a standing order or you'd carry out an individual transaction. I had nothing got to do with the €800 being removed. I did not agree to it. I was not made aware of it. And I'm just thinking, you know, had somebody done this to somebody else at an Easter weekend, they could remove 30 or 40 grand out of your bank account.
And so don't, first of all, there's a gang of them sitting there, John. We don't know where they are, but there's a gang of them sitting there. And the minute they're flying these texts all over the place, purporting to be from Unpost or not from Unpost.
Well, I never had one before, Joe.
Yeah, well then.
And what really nailed me is I was actually waiting on a delivery.
Yeah, I know.
So I was over at the garage this morning.
That's what they're banking on, you see. And a lot of people are waiting on the deliveries, but they're banking on it's all. They're throwing darts, and they hope some of them are presented. By the way, they are throwing thousands of darts, and they're hoping that a percentage of them will land. That's all they need. And the minute it goes bing, 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 someone else comes and sits beside your man or your woman to say, quick, give me the details. And before they don't have to log off and go into your bank, someone is sitting there ready to go into a bank. It's happening in milliseconds, in milliseconds.
Yeah. Well, I talked to a man yesterday in the bank as I was leaving. His daughter was scammed of €400. She went online and bought a ticket for a gig, and she ended up paying €400. And he said to me, you're probably one of about 7,000 today. And I was just thinking, you know, shouldn't there be an extra layer of security?
Well, the Bank of Ireland are telling us that if the customer clicked the link on the smishing text and filled in what's asked for in the fake text, they will have given their online banker user ID, their full 6-digit online banking PIN. And also...
Well, there's also an IBAN, Joe, that you're supposed to give, which stops international transactions. Wasn't there.
Yeah, did you get a once-off verification code to your phone number?
No. And I'm finding it very difficult to imagine that. You know, I asked him, why wasn't there a little time delay on this? That if you were doing online transactions and put a day before your money would actually leave...
If the payment did then need approval, that's done from the fraudster's device, as the customer has at this stage given the fraudster full access to use their account. So the fraudster is operating as the customer. I wish someone from Bank of Ireland would, because they're normally good on... They are normally good on this. Well... I remember, was it 4 years ago, there was a massive Bank of Ireland scam, and it featured for a good while on Liveline. And in fairness to Bank of Ireland, they reimbursed everybody, and I think that the amount was close to €1 million. But anyway, they did it, and now.
I was just thinking about this.
I presume Unpost are telling us we never send texts. I presume that's what Unpost are saying.
Well, let's see, I don't know if it was actually Unpost.
I know, but they were purporting to be the delivery company, aren't they? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I know, it could be anybody. But
well, it could have been a courier system.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know how... You know, the fact was that I just got one of these texts ever, and it was just the day before I got a delivery.
Yeah,
and a guard this morning in Raheny Garda Station told me exactly the same thing. He said he had online shopping done, and a day before they came, he got a delivery from, he got a text message from a courier firm. But he's very, very well aware of it. So
but just don't fall for any those scams. Those texts are just not true. And even if they are true, let them come and pursue it either by knocking on your door. Now, John, are you hopefully getting the poultry book?
Well, I'd love to get it, but I mean, it's taken a second season all of this, you know. Yeah. It's a very expensive poetry book, isn't it?
It sure is, 800 quid. I know there's rare books and rare books in it.
Mm-hmm.
But 800
I'd love
quid.
To get it, but Joe, I just thought to myself, we are living dangerously by hoping that these things won't happen to us, because they're so clever.
I know, they're everywhere. And there's a lot of them doing it, and they're ready to pounce. They are ready to pounce. And don't give your details to anybody, I think, anyway. But the more we say this, the more hopefully people will be saved money. But don't press that button. Don't give your bank details on your phone to anybody.
But there is another question, Joe, I'd just like to think about. Supposing you buy a camera tonight from what's obviously a legitimate firm, you pay for it, it's sent to you. How can you guarantee that they're not an organised crime gang that's just diagnosed and had your account details then?
Yeah, well, then it goes back to dealing with trusted websites.
But, I mean, who does that? I mean, when people go online, they buy something that they like. More and more people won't use PayPal because of the service charges. So you can buy a camera and they can wait 3 months. And just when they're not expecting it, they still have your details.
Well, hopefully if there are companies like that, and hopefully they're few and far between, that we'll find out about them through programs like this. Now, I know when the Bank of Ireland reimbursed those customers, and it was a significant amount. I know Francesca McDonough was the CEO. She's now moved on to better thing. I'm sure she's in New Zurich, isn't she? It's a better thing. So I don't know what the current policy is in the Bank of Ireland, but we'll await and see, John. We'll await and see.
Well, it's more or less a warning, Joe, to go
yeah,
out.
That's what this,
yeah. There is no way you can figure out what's happening to you unless you're very, very smart.
Don't be giving bank details to anybody. And by the way, as I say to people, when people ring you and say, this is wrong and that's wrong and we need this, you say, obviously, if you are my bank, you have my address. Buy a stamp and post the query to me and let it come through my hall door. And that will verify. That's the quickest way of verifying whether it's a legitimate company or not. John Farrelly, Guru Mina Mahaga.
Joe, good luck to you.
By the way, on this eve of St. Patrick's Day, in other words, Friday, want to try and have a bit of fun. We're in studio, obviously, but if you have a favourite, preferably, but not exclusively Irish comedian, be it Brendan Grace, be it Hal Roach, be it Maureen Potter, I'm thinking of all the people, be it Sean Connors, be it Sil Fox, anyone that has put out an album of Irish gags, Noel V. Guinity, if you've any of them and they're on record here in our archive, we will play your favourite gag, favourite joke. It doesn't have to be an Irish joke, obviously. And if there's American, or Billy Connolly also is in there, Les Dawson, anyone, any of that style, you're more than welcome. Or if you want to tell a joke yourself, submit your, by the way, there will be prizes for the best choices. 087-484-8888. 087-484-8888 is the WhatsApp audio, or joe@rte.ie for this eve of our national holiday this coming Friday.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
At this stage, I'm just going to say it loud and clear, without fear of retribution at this stage, because it's just gone beyond the beyond. Will people stop giving money to a company called Agri Global People? We've been doing it now for 3 months. We did it 5 years ago, and they were under a different name. It's run by a man called Niall Minogue. We keep telling or asking him for refunds. He says he will give the refunds, and they sell them. Sometimes they do, but they seldom materialise. So I'd say, at best, will people hold off giving money until we sort this out once and for all? Sharon Davis. Sharon, you contact us from Wales. You want to warn us about Niall Minogue and this agri-global people. What happened to you and your son, Reese?
Well, yeah, hello. Hey. Yes, Reese forwarded £3,000 as proof of funds.
Yeah.
And Agri,
because Reese wanted, like so many, Agri Global People are offering jobs in Australia, sometimes Canada and the States, but primarily Australia, New Zealand. And he wants proof of funds, Niall Minogue does.
He does, yes.
Yeah. And how much did he handed over £3,000.
£3,000, yeah.
Pounds, okay. And what happened? Where's the money?
Well, he has repaid £1,000 of it with a promise of another 1,000 this Friday, but I'm not holding out much hope.
Have you been in contact with him?
I ring him approximately 20 times a day and he never answers me.
Oh, Sharon. You must be exhausted.
Yeah, it is exhausting. It's frustrating. Yes, it's all that.
And does he ever reply? Does he reply?
He does reply every now and again. He did actually ring me this morning and say he was going to make a payment this coming Friday.
Surprise, surprise.
He told me that before.
This was after Tara rang him, I presume, but you're doing 20 a day. My God. My God. This is a statement. I might as well be reading graffiti on a public toilet in Dublin, if there was a public toilet to read graffiti on, and it says such should be the veracity of it. But anyway, Niall, you're welcome to come on the programme again and make more promises to people. But this, you have it now in writing. In recent weeks, AgriGlobal people have made a number of refunds to placements who just reimbursed in full people there over the weekend. Most notably, William Jefferson in Finland. And he's another name. I don't be reading that name. Sorry. He says we reached... By the way, we were not aware of... These people have not contacted us looking for the refunds. So there's a lot of people. We've assuaded people. And he's now mentioned other people that we were unaware of that were looking for their money back. We have made arrangements with the outstanding placements to make further payments into the coming period. AgriGlobal people would operate under a new and improved structure into the future, working in tandem with candidates and farms globally. Finally, I would like to apologise to individuals and families affected during this period. Where's Rhys? Rhys, are you in Australia? Rhys?
Rhys, yeah, Davis, I am. Hello.
How are you? Why were you taken in? But sorry, what was it about Niall Minogue that was so attractive to you?
Well, I saw all the adverts he had on Facebook and stuff.
Yeah.
And the way he presents it, like a very well set out company. But once you start dealing with him, you do very quickly learn that it is far from it.
And how soon did you realise that your money was in trouble, to say the least?
Well, I had promises made to me that it would be returned. I think it was in within like 5 working days after coming here and something, but like there was questions. I started questioning it because with booking the flights, it was very disorganized and it was very last minute with him. And I started doubting it then, to be honest.
And had you heard previously of people having difficulty with Niall Minogue?
No, I hadn't heard of nothing. Okay. I got put onto it by someone that I knew. They'd seen the adverts. I'd never heard of him, so I looked around his Facebook page and stuff, and I couldn't really see nothing wrong with it, but that's obviously what he wants you to think.
Yeah, of course, because he'd be cleansing everything to make sure. Stuart Hayes, stay there, Reese, if you can. Stuart Hayes, good afternoon.
How you doing? How you getting on?
Good. Where are you, Stuart?
I'm currently down at Belfast Docks here at the minute working.
Okay. Tell me about your relationship, your durable relationship with Niall Minogue.
Well, with Niall, I actually knew him as Neil. He told me he was a Neil.
Okay.
I never got his second name or anything like that.
Okay.
He seemed pretty legit, to be honest. He did, fair enough, get me out there, which I was happy enough. But
okay. But he looked for this extra money. He looked for proof of funds, I presume. This beautiful phrase which he uses.
Hello?
Can you hear me, Stuart? I know you're not.
Yes.
What extra money did he look for off you, Stuart, which are now outstanding?
Well, my flights, he wanted about £2,000 for my flights.
Nice.
And he told me that, if it was any cheaper, I'd get my money back. And then it worked out my flight was about £1,300. And then I contacted him. I says, look, could I get this money back, please, Neil? And eventually, he basically went cold turkey on me. He stopped replying. I tried ringing him and texting him, and then I just never got anything back from him.
Yeah. Oh, are you Neil? You said you call him Niall and Neil. Neil seems Neil seems to be the operative word. Neil, as in no. Neil, Neil, Neil. Yes. No, no, no. He'll say yes, yes, yes. That when people eventually get through to him, of course, and he'll say yes, yes, yes to us, saying I'll send the money back, but it's not happening. It's not happening.
Yeah.
Okay. A warning then to people. Just they have to make their own mind up as well. But Agri Global is a company. Neil or Niall Minogue is the man. Are you optimistic, Stuart, that you're going to get your £800 back, €1,000?
I don't really know. It's been over, like, it's been a year and a half, like, since he's owed me the money, and I haven't heard anything from him. He's read my messages, and then that's it. I haven't heard a thing.
See, he's hoping you'll give up.
That's probably what it is. Yeah.
Okay, Sharon Davies, don't give up.
No, I'm not going to.
Yeah, don't. Well done. By the way, are you running up a phone bill, Sharon? Like where?
I contact him through WhatsApp.
Good stuff.
Through the Wi-Fi system.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well done. Reese, how's Australia? I know you're still owed money, but you did get out to us. Well, anyone would have got you out to Australia in that sense. But how's Australia?
Yeah, it's very good. To be fair, I'm very much enjoying it over here.
Okay. Reese, your mother is on the case. She's brilliant.
Oh, she's a good one, to be fair. She's on it.
Okay, did you... I presume you were in contact with her for Mother's Day, Reese.
Yes, I did ring her. I'm not that bad.
Good lad. He's a good lad, Sharon.
He is, to be fair, yeah.
Yeah, rare, man. He's lucky to have such a tenacious... Miss Marple, as his dogged mother. Don't give up, Sharon, and keep in touch with us, please. Reese, Sharon,
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Reese, Sharon and Stuart, joe@rte.ie, 51551. Remember, if you have a particular Irish comedian you'd like to hear, obviously if they're on a record, so that includes people who have passed, including Hal, including Bren, and lots of other people, and Maureen, of course, the great Maureen Potter, Danny Coleman, if you do, or Jimmy O'D, bring me back. If you have any of them, please let us know, and you can participate. In the eve of our St. Patrick's Day special, joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And Peter Ryan is on the phone. Peter, we're used to...
Hi, Joe.
Well, seldom, but we've from time to time gone looking for a lost dog, especially if it's of an every dog, but if there's it's a last minute plea from somebody. But in your case, it's a variation on this. What are you looking for?
My dead dog's ashes. So, well, I'll tell you a bit about it, Joe.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
Yeah. So I live in England. My wife and my son and our late dog Thorpe. We were visiting family at Christmas, which we always do, and Thorpe got sick Christmas Eve. And Christmas Day, he wasn't improving. So I took him to a pet emergency hospital in UCD on Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm.
And they were fantastic. I couldn't fault them.
Okay.
But unfortunately, the Thorpe had to be put to sleep Stevens's morning at 2 a.m. So
there is, by the way, I didn't notice, there is an emergency veterinary hospital open on Christmas Day in Ireland.
You know what, Joe? It was fantastic. I didn't know that. It's 40 years since I lived in Dublin. So, and I'll tell you another thing that happened. Belfield, the entrance was closed because it was Christmas Day.
Okay.
And then I had to go all there trying to get an entrance. And I kept on asking people because I couldn't find it anyway. I asked this fellow who was walking his dog. And he could see I was in a bit of a state. And he said, you know what, follow me and I'll get you there.
Okay.
And it was the nicest thing anyone could do. And he got me to the hospital and the place was packed. I was there for 5 hours. But the people there were really fantastic. And even, you know, you put talking people there as well. And everyone had a story. We were all there in one boat, really, on Christmas Day, missing Christmas.
And who else? Just give me a picture of the waiting room, Peter. Were people with cats, dogs, Budgies?
Mainly dogs.
Okay.
And cats.
And what had happened insofar as you could generalize? What had happened to dogs?
Oh, he was sick in October, November, and he got better. And he just wasn't keeping food down. He was throwing up. And he went out on Christmas morning and he was trying to make him sick and he was retching and stomach was going. It wasn't nice. So,
The other dogs, why were they there on Christmas Day, do you know?
They were all there for various reasons. Yeah, okay. And all different shapes and sizes. And, you know, you see different emotions. There was one poor family, the little girl's dog, clearly had to be put down and she was so upset.
Oh, my God.
And it was there was a lot going on. And okay. You just talked to people and everyone was lovely. The staff were fantastic.
Okay.
So I left him there and I left at 9 o'clock because I said, I'll come back and see how he is in the morning. And then we got a phone call at 1 a.m. It says, can you come in? He's on the way out. And the three of us went in and we sat with him and, they gave him the little injection. Yeah, but it was really nice. And I could not fault the people. So we then came back to the UK and we'd arranged to get his ashes. He was going to be cremated and the UCD Vet Hospital did all that. And I got a phone call to say, oh, he's arrived on the, I think it was the 29th of January. So I booked a DPD pickup on the 29th of January. Long story short, it was 2 weeks till he actually picked the parcel up. I had to go back and forth to see what was going on. And I got to a stage on Monday evening here, there was still no sign of him. So I said, what am I going to do? And I says, I know what. Sorry, I'll ring Joe Duffy because he can do magic. So, and I just, I sent a speculative email out. And anyway, yesterday I get after an email was sent by your researcher, I got a correspondence from DPT to say, they found the parcel.
Oh, they found the ashes?
They seemingly have found it.
Okay, and where are they?
This morning I got... Oh, they're in a truck, allegedly, on my way here. But interestingly, this morning, I got two emails. One saying they're on their way, they were apologising. The other was saying, oh, we've done an investigation and we have deemed the parcel lost. So, I don't know what's going on, if I'm honest.
Okay, but I know you got it. You got a note saying the parcel. Well, the parcel was the ashes of Thorpe.
Yeah.
The parcel was lost. But has an email superseded that saying we found them? Timeline. Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And anyway, it's all a bit confusing. But the real reason I have an issue here, Joe, is it was the difference between the care I got at the hospital. And I can say that even though I lost my dog, and actually the lack of care with the courier company, and this is despite numerous phone calls, numerous hours on chatbots and chat messaging, it was just a disgrace. They just did not care. Okay. And
do they say when the ashes, they're calling it the parcel, they say when it might arrive to your home in the UK?
They said they missed the shipment last night.
Okay.
And they'd keep me up to date. So that's where I'm at anyway. So I really appreciate your help.
Okay. Well, DPD have told us they acknowledge mistakes were made on this occasion. A review is currently taking place. The parcel in question is being delivered tomorrow. Will you let us know, Peter?
Absolutely, yes.
And how, well, obviously, by the way, where did Thorpe get his name or her name?
Well, Thorpe, he's a boy. A local village to us is called Barley Thorpe.
Okay.
And the lady who bred him had two pups. And his brother's Barley and we got Thorpe. So Thorpe is very much a house dog. We've got one son and he was like another child. So, he was fantastic.
Okay, where will you? And he was 12 in Cocker Spaniel. Where will you put Thorpe's ashes? Where do people put the ashes that belong to their?
Well, my wife and I were thinking about that. We took him to the local playing fields near us and there's our back garden. So places where he loved and he loved to run around and sniff and do all doggy things. So, but we just wanted closure, if I'm perfectly honest with you.
Okay. Maybe then when you scatter the ashes, maybe all his little mates running around, the other Cocker Spaniels will sniff, and some of them say, that's Tarp. I recognise Tarp. I say a little prayer for him. Anyway, no important pets are. By the way, you're following the story, because I have, because we featured it here on Liveline, but obviously a different context, but about vet prices, especially for treating small animals. There's now an inquiry been launched in the UK saying about the veterinary prices, because apparently, this is not an imputation of wrongdoing, but I didn't know this. Apparently, the majority of veterinary practices are owned in the UK by a small number of companies.
I think about six companies.
Six companies own 60% of the business, and the prices are open to question. Anyway, Peter, I'm glad we know this time tomorrow. And I presume Thorpe's ashes are in a casket or a presentation box or a can.
No, we didn't go for that, John.
Didn't go for that. Okay.
We just want them back to say goodbye.
Okay. Well done. And well done to the veterinary hospital in UCD. Isn't that brilliant?
And the receptionist there, and the man who took the time to actually drive through UCD campus, because I would never have got to the hospital.
Incredible,
lots of kindness.
To think that they were open on Christmas Day. And they might say, well, why not? Well, you could say, well, if someone's pet was sick on Christmas Eve, they bring them there and then. But anyway, that didn't happen, and there are emergencies, as we're now discovering. And did you say your children are... Your children were upset, obviously. Your son, you have a son.
Yeah, we've one son who's at university. He's doing agriculture and farm business management. So, we got him when he was afraid of dogs. So we got Thorpe to get him over the fear. So,
okay. And is your son from a farming background, Peter?
No. We live in a housing estate. So he's mad into the farming. He's at a uni in near Newport, which is quite a lot of Irish there.
Yeah.
So he's got the St. Patrick's ball at Harbour Adams Uni.
Okay.
So
who's telling me your son used to drive a tractor to school?
Yeah, I was telling this to a researcher. My son is mad into driving. So when he was 16, he passed his tractor license over in the UK.
Which are allowed, same here, yeah.
Yeah, and his uncle had, he'd a freight business, and he'd a few tractors. So my son Adam went over to the UK, and he drove it from Dublin Port over into Liverpool, and drove it from Liverpool up to where we are in the Midlands.
Good lad.
And he used to drive to school just to show off, I think. He did that for a few months.
And as Massey Ferguson. Okay, what does he love about farming? I find it very attractive. I really do. Okay, Peter Ryan, good luck to you and your family. Hopefully Thorpe's ashes arrive tomorrow. joe@rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And joe@rt.ie. Margaret, good afternoon.
Joe, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. And, not that you need reminding, but obviously what's happening and what's happened to Charlie Bird over the last few years and the campaign he ran to try and raise awareness of motor neuron disease. You don't need a mention of it for that stab of pain, your daughter died through and with motor neuron disease 6 years ago, Sharon.
Yes.
And when was she diagnosed, Margaret?
She was diagnosed in 2012, and she was. And every case, I'm sure, is different. She was grounded very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Sharon was in a wheelchair within 6 months of being diagnosed.
Okay.
And within a few months of that, she lost her voice.
What prompted the diagnosis, Margaret? What prompted her to?
She actually was complaining of the muscle in her left leg.
Okay.
And her shoe wouldn't stay on. She couldn't hold on her shoes.
Okay.
And she tended to fall, trip very easy and fall. And she used to try and walk during her lunch hour. And she'd walk, and she wasn't walking that successful. And then she decided to bring a bicycle into work.
Okay.
And she'd go off on the bicycle, trying to cycle on the bicycle, you know, to get a bit of exercise. So never, ever, ever, ever suspecting.
Yeah.
But, you know, through a process of elimination, it was diagnosed that she had motor neuron. So you can imagine the bombshell it was for us and for the whole thing. Yeah,
she was
shocking. Yeah,
she was only 38 years
old. And full of life.
Yeah, and did people know what motor neuron disease was?
No,
2012,
no.
14
no.
years ago.
I mean,
ago,
it's
yeah.
not only four. Yeah, I mean, it's such a short time, 12 years ago. Such a short time, really. No, yeah. I mean, I knew it was nasty, but I didn't know what nasty really meant, if you know what I mean. I don't think I really knew. It was, initially I didn't really realise it was terminal, so quickly it could happen. I didn't ever want to research it. My husband did.
Okay.
He was very anxious to research it. And we have a daughter in America, and she sent home lots of books on ALS, as they called it there. And I couldn't go near those books. I had to live each day as it came. You know, I take it from there. Really. I couldn't have dealt with it had I known the real consequences.
Yeah. And when did you realise that MND has not got, at that stage, definitely did not, had not got the level of research and investment and scientific study? I know people are doing their absolute utmost and now especially.
Yeah.
But when did you realise that, use that awful phrase, that it was terminal and there's nothing that can be done?
Well, I actually didn't know from the very beginning.
Okay.
Because the day she came home from hospital, having been diagnosed officially, needless to say, it was shocking. It was all, you know, it was terrible. And I remember kind of getting myself somewhat composed and asking her, so, okay, what are they going to give you? Because you know the way, you know, you step up there, you get in the bandwagon, you take the medication or whatever is recommended, and you work from there, really. And she shook her head and she said there isn't anything. And I thought, Jesus, I mean, you can't, you know. And then I thought, and you know, look now, and in hindsight, and it probably was silly, but I said, okay, where in the world can we go that can get you sorted? Because honestly, you know, for your child, what are you going to do? And she said, there is nowhere. And sure enough, there isn't anywhere, as we all know. Yeah. Well, you know. So that's a shocking prognosis, really, and to realise. I mean, your life hits you in the face when you hear something like that. I mean, I knew how bad and serious it was then.
Yeah.
At that point in time, you know. But just fight, and you'll fight to do anything.
Of course you will.
And if there's any possibility and any alternative you can think of, you come across, you'll go for that. Of course you will.
Yeah.
You know. But.
And then as Charlie was, he was under the care of the team led by Professor Orla Hardiman in
Bournemouth. Yeah,
And she was diagnosed, and how long after the diagnosis? Charlie was almost 3 years to the day, because as I said yesterday, there's a bizarre coincidence in that Charlie had been on this programme talking about a news story on June the 6th, 2021, and I happened to ring him 4 days later to say thanks very much and any news, any whatever is happening. And he said, I've just come out of the GP. I was worried about my voice. It was Charlie's voice that went through.
Yeah,
And he had ordered, GP had ordered a brain scan, just got the results of a brain scan. Nothing obvious, but he wants me to have another brain scan. And Charlie said to me on that phone call, and I was in the car on that Saturday morning, he said, I'm convinced I have MND, even though he had no symptoms. I don't know, but obviously he was in the shadow of our great colleague Colin Murray and indeed Father Tony Coote, who also led a public campaign. So Sharon lived for after the diagnosis for 5.5 years.
Yes, she was, you know, because I was following Charlie's progress of deterioration.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know, very keenly from the word go. And, you know, I not that I was monitoring or measuring,
yeah,
but she was grounded so quickly.
Okay.
And apparently, if it's lower, it comes from the legs up.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's upper, it
comes
down. Travels down, yeah. You know, yeah, yeah. But she didn't get any length of time. She was within 6 months. She got her car adapted, and that she only got about, I'd say, 4 or 5 months of it. She didn't even get out of the car driving it adapted, you know. And
as you say, you remember then, the day I heard on radio, this is your letter, that Charlie had been diagnosed with MND.
I remember. I kind of have known of a few people, knew a few people that I kind of knew, extended friends.
Mm-hmm.
And when I get, particularly when I know somebody, but even to hear anybody being diagnosed, it's gut wrenching.
And but you say there is the piercing pain of grief, sadness, shock, and recurring memories, but there is another side to this awful, nasty MND. It brings out, these are your words, it brings out so much love, courage, bravery, generosity, honesty, and so many qualities from everyone touched by this monster. Thank you, Charlie, for allowing us to share your life. Thank you, Sharon, as well, and for the wonderful needed fundraising for the usually vital IMNDA, Irish Motor Neuron Disease, and I tweeted a link to that yesterday. God rest Sharon, Margaret. Godspeed and blessing to you and her son. I think she had
a gorgeous. Oh, okay. And she had a tremendous husband. He absolutely was a fantastic guy. And still is a fantastic guy.
Yeah, of course.
Absolutely. He made her life. He loved her to the bitter end, and which was lovely. Yeah. It was lovely for us to see that. But she did amazing things in about 5.5 years. She actually went on, she did an interview with Pat Kenny.
Brilliant, brilliant.
And we went into the studios and she did it through her IGA's computer.
Well done. Well done.
So, I mean, that technology was incredible.
Yeah.
You know, but Charlie, I think, educated a lot, made people very aware of what the illness was about.
Thanks indeed, Margaret. And I say, God rest Sharon. Kieran Cullen's on sound. John Riley is researcher. Producer is Nadine Maloney. Katie Hannon will be here tomorrow because I'm going in to Charlie's funeral. And there's lots of people going to speak. It's in the round room, the Mansion House, by the way, at noon. And I'm told people are invited. It's a big venue, obviously pride of place and to Charlie's remains, but also... Claire is going to speak, his daughters, I'm told, are in NASA, and his grandchildren are going to, and that's the most important, that those people have pride of place, because so many people want to participate. And I'll say what I've always wanted to say, and I said it again over the last 24 hours in numerous platforms, broadcast platforms, in his long and vibrant life. And I say this to Sharon as well, whose life was shorter, Margaret was talking about, and his enthusiastic living through his dying. And Sharon, as Margaret said, did the same. She gave interviews. Charlie Bourde changed Ireland for good, and he changed us all for the better. May he rest in peace.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.